And one last reminder to our audience, the views and opinions that were expressed during this program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the opinions or positions of Portland Community College, PCC Foundation, or KBOO-FM. Thank you for listening to Let's Talk, PCC's broadcast about disability culture. And as a reminder, you can find more information and resources concerning this episode at kboo.fm/shows. And you can also go to pcc.edu/DCA and follow the link to Let's Talk Podcast Collective. We work with accessible education and disability resources at PCC, the PCC Multimedia Center and Department, and KBO. We're posting newly recorded content bi-weekly, and we're here on KBOO-FM on the first Friday of every month for a live show and the last Friday for a pre-recorded show. Thanks again for listening.
It's your eyes. I swear they look at me.
That was good.
That was so good.
I hope I didn't talk. Mix it with the smile, right? They come together. Perfect harmony, prettiest song there'll never be. Now, ain't got no game, babe. Ain't got no game, but ain't got no shame, babe. Ain't got no shame. And I don't know what it is when I hear your name. Suddenly, I just gotta say.
Hi, this is Cecil Prescott. Celeste Carey and I are the co-hosts for More Talk Radio, which airs on KBOO FM 90.7 on Mondays at 8 a.m. For 30 years, Celeste and I have been encouraging and engaging interviews and conversations about politics, social issues, and things which concerns you, your family, and your community. Join us on Mondays at 8 a.m. and be a part of this community radio experience.
Hi, it's Al Franken telling you to listen to KBOO, KBOO, Community Radio 90.7 here in Portland.
Good morning, this is Disability Justice, an everyday pursuit and survival. Your host, John Griffiths.
And Dina Wilder,
board operator.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, and you can always go to kboo.fm and click on the big red donate button so you can continue to support programs like ours. Today, in our interview with journalist Alexander Rakin, we unfortunately had some background noise as he was in a lobby. So please forgive some of the background noise. Thank you for listening to Disability Justice, and this is a topic on eugenics, so just be prepared.
So my name is Alexander Rakin. I'm a freelance journalist. My writing has been covered hundreds of times by other publications, including the New York Times, Washington Post, the Daily Mail, et cetera, et cetera. I've been writing about eugenics and euthanasia now for about 2 years.
Can you give us some background on how the forced sterilization of people with disabilities has been a form of eugenics?
Yeah, I mean, this is something that the historian Martin Pernick describes as a form of cultural amnesia, that both in Canada and in the United States, there has been a very long history of sterilization, both forced and, you know, let's use quotation marks over this, voluntary sterilization as well. The very first sterilization program was in the state of Indiana in 1907. By the time that we reached in the early 1930s, more than half of all U.S. states had a form of sterilization. Canada, meanwhile, in Alberta and British Columbia, also had sterilization programs. In fact, it was the only place in the British Commonwealth or British Empire that had any programs of forced sterilization. So the point of all this is that the history in North America of sterilization has then been expanded to, well, to Germany. By the time that you have the Nazi Party seizing control inside of Germany, the history of sterilization programs in Germany are a direct descendant of the sterilization programs that happened in North America.
From what I understand, involuntary sterilization is still a possibility within 31 states within the United States, including Oregon. Is forced sterilization still something within Canada as well?
Canada has a bicameral legislature, right? So there's a House of Commons and there's a Senate. There was a Senate committee that looked into involuntary sterilization of Indigenous women. And they actually reported that their most recent example that they found, I believe, was like 2019. Right. So not that very long ago. In theory, it was voluntary. And again, we're using quotation marks here because it involved heavily pregnant women about to give birth or in the middle of giving birth, being forced to essentially being forced to sign documentation that they consent to being sterilized. And that is what Canada's the Senate of Canada investigative committee looking into this has found. So, yes, it is still happening, though obviously the programs that existed previously have stopped, and most of them stopped in the 1960s or the 1950s. But we do still have individual cases of forced sterilization happening with people with disabilities and with other racial minorities.
That seems just incredible to me that that barbarity is still going on. In our last program, Megan, she touched on the MAID program in Canada. And can you give us some more in-depth description?
Yes. So MAID stands for Medical Assistance in Dying. It is a form of voluntary euthanasia in Canada, right? So in 2016, you had around 1,000 voluntary deaths. In 2022, you had over 13,000 MAID deaths. This is the fastest growing voluntary euthanasia program that the world has ever seen.
Is there any like statistics kept on like how many of these people are people with disabilities?
Yes. So I'm actually writing a paper just about this. Essentially, all the data that we have about the exact demographics of the people who are requesting and qualifying for medical assistance in dying in Canada is essentially information by the physicians and nurse practitioners responsible for it. Right. So they're essentially telling the government that according to their patients, this is what they said, or these are what their demographics are. Right. And these are the same people who are potentially criminally liable if they make any mistakes. In practice, no one has ever been prosecuted, even in cases that arguably should have been. But it's still, you know, essentially you're tattling on yourself, if that makes any sense. Because we don't actually have direct data on the number of people with disabilities, but we do have data on the number who, according to the physicians responsible, their patients needed to have disability supports. Between 2019 and 2022, around 15,000 persons who required disability services died through MAID, which represents almost half of the total number of MAID deaths. And another 8,000 had an unknown disability status. The MAID physicians and or nurse practitioners had no idea whether their patients required disability services or received them. Between 2019 and 2022, more concerningly, we had over 585 people who died from MAID who required disability services but did not receive it.
Yeah, I mean, we've had that happen over here where people didn't get the services and they chose death because they weren't getting any help.
Yeah, this isn't even a headline in Canada. So the total number of people who died from assisted suicide in Washington State was around 480, right? You have more than that of people who required disability services, did not receive those disability services, even though they required it, and instead received medical assistance in dying. On top of that, the median wait time between requesting MAID in Canada and actually dying for MAID in Canada in 2022 was only 11 days. That's median.
Wow.
It's also an open secret that disability organizations in Canada have a list of cases of concern of MAID deaths targeting people with disabilities. Instead of the government being the one to actually scrutinize MAID deaths and to ensure that people with disabilities are receiving the proper form supports that they are legally entitled to, both under Canadian law and also, I mean, under Canada's constitution and also under international law. Canada is a signatory of the UNDRP, right? The United Nations Statement on Disability Rights. It's not the government who's actually scrutinizing this data. And instead, it's disability organizations across Canada who are the ones who are essentially collecting lists of people with disabilities who have died through MAID instead of being able to receive disability services and supports that they are both legally and morally entitled to. The United States as well, like Washington State, 10% of all assisted deaths in Washington State, according to the physicians who are actually providing assisted suicide in Washington State, said that their patients were concerned over the financial implications of treatment. What was supposed to be or billed as an option of last resort when everything else has been exhausted and someone who's fully autonomous, you know, is capable of deciding, you know, that they no longer want to pursue other treatments and instead they want to have a dignified death, right? That's what this was billed as. In reality, we're seeing that dying with dignity is not very dignified. And instead, we see the number of millions of dollars that have gone into lobbying for assisted dying instead of assisted living has garnered, you know, an almost dystopian system.
Well, I mean, isn't that the way it is when you have a capitalistic system? It's always money over living beings.
You know, it's interesting because this is somewhere where you can describe what is happening, you know, in terms of ableism, which it is, ageism, which it is, eugenics, which it is, right? And you can also describe it in terms of, well, this is what happens when we view human beings and human life as no longer dignified, right? The fact that the word dignity, the root word dignitas, has been usurped from said meaning that every single human being shares an inherent dignity that cannot be taken away, right? That it doesn't matter how elderly someone is or how many disabilities they have or the impact it's having on their lives, that they're still human beings. This has been usurped into arguing that human life is not sacred. And, you know, it, as more progressive as we've become, right, in certain regards, it seems that we have definitely taken regress back. And this is the part where I think the history of forced sterilization in North America is very pertinent with the conversation over euthanasia. The very first legislation that was debated, or that was introduced, I should say, to legalize euthanasia or assisted suicide was, as you could imagine, was the state of Indiana. It was in 1906. That proposition failed. And instead, the next year, that's when sterilization was introduced in the state of Indiana, and it passed. Some people are not so aware of is that 2 years later, Indiana actually canceled its sterilization program. However, the genie was out of the bottle, right? And as I mentioned previously, that eventually you would have a majority of U.S. states having some form of sterilization program. What I think is really important to stress, right, is that the same organizations that were pushing for sterilization programs, that were pushing for eugenics, were the same groups that were also pushing for assisted suicide and euthanasia. The difference being is that since the 1960s, the state programs or national programs in some cases of forced sterilization, they were largely canceled. So as a political movement, it largely failed. Though again, there are these exceptions of individual physicians doing things that, I mean, they look illegal, they sound illegal, and they probably are illegal. And yet prosecutors are not prosecuting and judges are not convicted. On the books, it should be legal. So as a political movement, sterilization has largely failed. However, what we've seen with euthanasia is that even though they were introduced at roughly the same time, the first political success of this movement came in the late 20th century, right? So Oregon assisted suicide program, which passed in the late 1990s, and I mean, Canada's euthanasia program, right, which was considered to be some form of legal right in 2015, has then been pushed from what was supposed to be limited and rare into becoming one of the most common forms of death in Canada. So in 2022, MAID, if it was actually described as a cause of death for whatever reason, the government of Canada does not consider euthanasia to be a technically a cause of death. But if you were to consider it as a cause of death, it would be tied as the fourth or fifth most common cause of death in Canada.
You've obviously talked about Washington and Oregon, but what about states like California, Hawaii, Colorado, Indiana, any other states proceeding towards a MAID program?
Yes. So to be clear, all of those states besides Indiana have an assisted suicide program. Over 10, so 10 states and the District of Columbia have a form of assisted suicide. And I'll just clarify the difference. So in Canada, almost all cases are euthanasia, which is when the physician or the nurse injects the patient with lethal medication. In the United States, it's only assisted suicide, which is a physician or a nurse practitioner or a nurse in some cases prescribes lethal medication, and then you take it yourself. In the U.S., it is rarer, but we've seen massive increases in the number of suicides just over the last couple of years. So in California, for instance, in 2022, the number of assisted suicides have increased by over 63%. They removed many important safeguards. They watered them down, just like elsewhere. And again, this only impacts for people with disabilities. So in the U.S., theoretically, you need to have a terminal illness with a prognosis of under 6 months. However, in all those states, we've seen cases of like anorexia, right, which is a treatable illness, right? Yes, people with anorexia do die, but it is a treatable illness. I interviewed quite a few eating disorder experts, right, who have told me that, you know, at any point within, you know, for someone who has anorexia, it is possible for them to get better. Anorexia has not typically been seen as a terminal illness. And yet, we've seen anorexia qualify. We have bioethicists who are pushing for voluntary stopping eating and drinking as a way to qualify. And again, an average physician probably wouldn't say that, oh, well, you know, this able-bodied person has stopped eating and drinking for 2 days, therefore they should qualify for assisted suicide. However, I think you would see quite a few physicians, just as previously, who, if a person has disabilities and they stop eating and drinking, then they would say, okay, well, now you qualify for assisted suicide. So what we typically had before was suicide prevention for everyone. Now we have suicide assistance, and it's only for people with disabilities. And yeah, so we've seen safeguards rescinded. There's still an ongoing push to expand assisted suicide. There was a potential for California's assisted suicide program to implement euthanasia. That actually died in the committee, but you know, it's an open secret that they're going to introduce it at a later date. We've also seen that disability organizations like Not Dead Yet and other prominent national disability organizations have raised the alarm on this. They challenged California's assisted suicide bill in court. They lost their first, so they lost the trial decision. I don't know if they're going to appeal it or not. But at the same time, you do have disability groups who are raising the alarm on this. And there are powerful supporters who believe that their arguments are right. So interestingly enough, as in the trial decision in California against Not Dead Yet and a group of other disability organizations, the trial judge essentially said that there's no way that that California's End of Life Act actually discriminates against people with disabilities. But you want to know who does think that it does? Justice Ooh. Gorsuch, who sits in the Supreme Court, right? So you have Supreme Court justices who, or at least one, Neil Gorsuch, who in his book on euthanasia and assisted suicide, has literally made that same argument that a trial judge, disagreed with. So the fight is still on. I personally think it's going to get worse until it gets better. But we've seen that this is primarily a disability. This is a movement. The resistance to assisted suicide has been primarily led by people with disabilities.
Has any of this come before the news media? I mean, I know I asked you about Canada, but have we seen anything within the American news media on this issue of eugenics and forced sterilization and assisted suicide? And have we seen anything like telling people that, you know, this is going on? I mean, other than yourself.
I mean, we've seen in some academic journals who have made this argument. We've seen from some disability groups that have made this argument, but in terms of national media, not really, no. And that's to the eternal shame of national media. You know, I can list some names of people who have written about this. Tim Staden has written about this. You know, Katrin Frazee has written about this. But all of those people are not journalists.
I was just kind of like, have you ever heard of any story where maybe a person with an intellectual disability was talked into assisted suicide rather than giving the option for them to continue living?
Yeah, so, I mean, there have been different discussions over it. I mean, first of all, we have people with intellectual disabilities in Canada, at least, who have qualified for assisted suicide in euthanasia. These are people with dementia or precursors to dementia. I've written for the National Review an article that covered that within, so there's an organization in Canada called the Canadian Association of MAID Assessors and Providers, or CAMAF for short. They are the self-described experts in assisted suicide, right? So they are the ones who are pushing assisted suicide. They're the ones who are, you know, actually doing the work, so to speak. As Stephanie Green, their president, the president of that organization, describes it, that they're the ones who do the work. And I covered for National Review, there was an incident where at an internal CAMAF seminar, they laughed about euthanizing a patient when the patient was either resisting or it was unclear if the patient really wanted to go through with it. To clarify, in Canada, that is possible. There used to be the requirement that there was, you needed to have a final consent before euthanasia be administered. Canada in 2021 removed that agreement. If a patient would enter into a voluntary written agreement, so that's not signed, it doesn't have to be signed, but it's just a written agreement with one of their two MAID providers or assessors. So the family doesn't need to know. The other MAID assessor doesn't need to know. The patient doesn't need to even be fully approved for MAID for this to happen. And yet there's an asterisk in that agreement that agreement is only enforced if the patient is not showing any signs of resistance at the, before MAID is administered. So the question came up, well, what happens if the patient is resisting? And these physicians at CAMAP seminar, and again, I posted a recording of it on my Twitter page, as well as writing about this for National Review. These physicians were laughing over the fact that they could sedate the patient first. And in fact, one of them said that that's what they did. They administered hydromorphone. Because again, the law as it stands was only protecting patients from euthanasia if they're resistant to the euthanasia. Resisting sedation, however, is not necessarily a part of euthanasia. So they openly discuss this. We also know that the number of people with intellectual, so that's a more advanced form of dementia. But that is essentially an advanced directive. At the end of the day, that's what is going to happen, right? If you're trying to kill a patient, because let's be honest, that's what's happening. You're trying to kill a patient who is not capable of consenting to it at the time of their death. So that is already happening. We also know that people with intellectual disabilities have already qualified for it. We know that people with depression have already qualified for it. There was a case with Duncan. I'm completely blanking on her first name, but her last name is Duncan, who was a nurse who had a history of depression. She was institutionalized. And then after she came out of the institution home, within 48 hours, she was euthanized. So her daughters were very apoplectic about it, right? How could their mother have possibly consented when she was deemed that she couldn't consent to anything? I was with an imminent risk of her life and needed to be institutionalized in a psychiatric facility. And yet, nothing happened of that. The sisters testified to the parliamentary committee, but they requested medical documentation about their mother and why she was deemed that she was capable of consenting. That was not granted because of medical confidentiality laws, even though their mother was already dead, right? So even post facto, after May death, the family, right, who are the executors for her estate, were not given permission of accessing those documents. And remember, those are the stories that have come out, right? They do not include, all the other cases of individuals who are, who are living below the poverty line, who have depression, right? Who are alone, who are socially isolated. We don't have their stories.
I want to get to one more question before we leave. Eugenics has caused wars, and from what I know, the UN was developed to prevent nations from going to war, and I'm just kind of like wondering, so what stance is the UN taking on? Because if we're doing it here in Canada and the United States, it's probably spreading into Europe and a few other nations. So what is being done about putting people with intellectual disabilities, physical disabilities, and emotional disabilities, through suicide?
Right. I mean, look, as I mentioned previously, right, the UNDRP, right, the United Nations Declarations on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities should theoretically prohibit this, right? It prohibits discrimination against people with disabilities. I don't have the exact number of countries I've signed on to it, but there are quite a few countries I've signed on to this. I think it's well over 150. So theoretically, it should not be happening. However, as with international law, we know that it is not enforced until nation states start urging for the enforcement. And similar to what happened with sterilization programs in the past, until we have, the opposition goes mainstream, and it is not just people with disabilities urging the government to take their lives seriously, I don't think that those declarations are going to go very far. We have special rapporteurs on rights of persons with disabilities who have raised the alarms. Right, in Canada, you do not even need to have a terminal illness to qualify for medical assistance in dying. Right, so you can just have it. In fact, in the law itself, it says that you need to have an illness or disability that is causing grievous or irremediable medical suffering. In certain cases, that has been interpreted to include hearing loss. And in fact, if you go on Canada's most recent annual document by Health Canada summarizing 2022's number of mini deaths, in fact, there's even a subcategory of vision or hearing loss, right? So think about it. It happens so commonly that they needed to create a special subcategory to include these people, right, where the medical suffering is vision or hearing loss. I don't think any sane country, right, should have that. I don't think that's a very controversial opinion, right? Even amongst people who support made in theory for, certain cases. Though I think that what has happened in Canada and other jurisdictions shows that once you open the door a little bit, it is very difficult to keep it closed.
Yeah, we could go on and on and on and talk. But unfortunately, my time is coming to an end. Do you have a website that people can go on and look over this stuff?
Yeah, so right now, yes. Yeah, so right now you can follow me on Twitter. It's my first name and last name, Alexander Raikin. I'm going to be joining a new organization soon. Unfortunately, I can't say exactly which one, but I'll have a more documented presence coming up soon.
All right. Well, thank you for coming on to our show and for doing it. I really do appreciate this. This is the first time we actually had a journalist. And I want to thank you for coming on. And, we might do something again in the future, if at all possible. Stay safe out there.
That's the end of Disability Justice. Since we cannot be fully aware of everybody's difficulties within the community, we would really like it if you would send us your email, disabilityjustice@kbu.org.
Also, we're always looking for fun, inexpensive things to do out in the community. Go to disabilityjustice@kboo.org to contact us and give us your ideas.
Hey, what's up, everyone? It's Greg McVicar, creator of Undercurrents, and this is KBOO 90.7 Portland.
Hi, I'm Tammy.
Hi, I'm Althea.
We're the hosts of The Gap on Fridays at 8 a.m.
It's a talk radio show aimed at bridging